to Shock and Chip. If you haven't noticed, we are going every other week now that we're in the summertime. So we didn't forget about y'all. We didn't slack off. We didn't stop the whole production. We're just going every other week. We didn't get to talk about Phil winning between the PGA Championship and now because we took last week off. That was awesome. Memorial Day. Awesome. We were sharing photos of our plates and everything, and Mike was making us super jealous with his spread. So it's been a good couple of weeks, guys.
Mike, can you just go through for a minute? Just give the people, before the great Jack Bowerly comes on here, can you give the people the spread that you had and what you did? I mean, you had a process for what you made, and it looked tremendous.
I found this recipe. I found this blog, first of all, and God dang it, I cannot remember the name of it, so I'll shout it out at some point.
Well, whatever the name of the blog was, it had a story that was probably about 18 paragraphs long before it actually got to the recipe, did it not?
Pretty much. And lots of SEO words in it.
Oh, yeah.
But, but it was about this guy that was he had his doctorate, he was a professor at Cornell.
Yeah.
And Cornell's got a big ag school, and they were doing research in the 50s and 60s on some of these folks that had chicken farms, and they were turning out chickens that maybe weren't as big as some of the other farms. And it was, how can we come up with a chicken recipe that makes these smaller birds cook as well as the bigger birds do? Even though there's less meat, there's no flare-ups, so it's called Cornell Chicken. And it's a marinade, and just off the top of my head, it's apple cider vinegar, an egg, vegetable oil. Oh, geez, I can't remember what else. There's two or three other little things in it.
So what are you doing? Are you bathing that stuff in the chicken?
You're bathing the chicken in that, and we put the chicken in that for 24 hours. But put it in 24 hours, put it in the fridge.
Whoa.
Then got it out. Let it cool off. I mean, let it come to room temperature a little bit. I put Coach Whittemore, who obviously played here, coached here, was in our facilities department for a little while. He gives us these cans of his rub that he makes up, a secret rub that he makes up at Christmas time. So I put the rub on the chicken and then put the chicken on and basted it with what was left over of the marinade.
Ooh.
Did that, got it to about, I want to say about a 160 internal temperature, and then fired it up a little bit more so the skin would get a little bit brown and crisp.
Oh, I like that.
I mean,
I'm
looking at the pictures now. It almost looked like it was fried chicken. Almost. Not entirely.
That's probably not fair. That's because in reality, it didn't look that way.
Okay.
But it looked like a really, really almost perfectly done grilled chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Now I don't cook over an open flame, so I didn't. But supposedly this recipe is very good if you do cook over an open flame. But it's made more to do with indirect heat, and then you finish it under an open flame.
Mike, do you ever punch the chicken?
Yeah, you were supposed to do that. We did that with this stuff too.
Oh, okay.
We did that, and it said one of the reasons you do that is it lets the fat escape and the skin gets crispier.
Ooh. Just makes it cook a little more evenly.
Yeah,
that's what I say. Yeah, because it can get it through the holes, the heat and all that. Yeah, yeah.
But this was specifically, you know, normally you hear like punch into it so the marinade goes into the meat. This specifically said make sure you punch the skin, because it lets the fat escape from under the skin and gives the chicken, gives it a chance to get crispy. Otherwise, it's the skin gets a little rubbery.
Mike, I ain't gonna lie, this chicken look real flavorful.
Looks great.
It looks very good.
These are four bone-in breasts. Is that right?
Yeah, they were big. They were real big.
Okay.
What did the family say?
They liked it. My son, my youngest son, who doesn't like anything, he kept going back.
Okay.
I cooked those on Sunday.
Yeah, that was Sunday.
No, cooked those Sunday. They were gone by Monday night.
And then you did the corn, the corn on the cob too.
I did corn with them.
That's a must.
On the cob. Yeah, soak the corn, soak it in salt water, and then with the husk on it. But you take the silk off it.
Yeah.
But you leave the husk on. Soak it. Put a little bit of olive oil and salt on it, and just throw it on there.
See, I do the opposite. When I do corn, I put it. I put some little seasoning on it, put the oil on it, and I wrap it up in. I'll wrap it up in foil.
I've done it that way too. Punch the corn too,
so it can breathe.
Corn's resilient. You can do it anyway. And if you mess it up, just throw it in the pot and boil it. You know, it's just a great safety net.
So, yeah. Mike, how long did it take for the cooking the chicken to cook?
I want to say we put them on like 3 o'clock, and I think we ate them about 6 o'clock. So not real long.
Okay,
not real
nice.
Long.
Nice.
Chicken, you know, people look at a chicken and they say, "Oh, you can't mess up chicken." But I feel like it's one of the easier things to mess up because you can either dry it out, or you get some really chewy. And when you eat an undercooked bite of chicken, there is nothing unsettling than that.
It makes you just want to get up from the table and puke.
It's terrible. It is so bad. But
Wes, you had a little spread too, right?
Yeah, I did. We did the link sausage from a local butcher around town, and some dogs. Nothing wild.
And what's funny is I did the same thing on Friday night. I think it was Saturday night.
Yeah, Sunday
we
did burgers.
We went out to Striplings out here on 78 outside of town.
What strip club? What'd you say?
Striplings.
Oh, my bad. You said Striplings. My bad.
Not a sponsor, just a proud customer. Although, I'll tell you what, I miss seeing Mike Bobo and his kids in there. I used to run into him in there on Saturday mornings.
I saw a picture of his son, Drew, man, up with Kirby taking pictures. I was like, that's crazy.
I know.
Crazy.
But they do really nice sausage and brats.
Yeah.
And I did. We went and got some brats from there. Our guest here. I'm going to let him in.
All right.
So you want to throw to a break?
Let's do it. We'll be right back with Jack Bauer Lee. Not Jack Bauer.
Bauer.
We'll be right back. All right. Jack Bauer Lee joining Shock and Ship this week. And Coach, great to talk to you as always. You've been around the Georgia facilities as you have the Vince Dooley helmet. You're proudly showing off, telling us as we came in that he's the guy that hired you. And I mean, what a special legacy, special career you've had at Georgia. Thank you for coming on. And what is the summer like for you? What goes on as a swimming coach at a nationally recognized program before school, you know, really gets back in the swing?
Well, we don't see what you would think of as summer until August. So we just, as soon as NC2As are over, our best swimmer, even the ones in college, but we have a pro group also. But we don't really have any days off. We just sort of keep on trudging, particularly on a year like this because of Olympic trials starting on the 13th here out in Omaha. So when we came back from NCAAs with the men, for instance, that was Sunday. We got in here, I guess, about Sunday morning. And we were in the water a little bit on Monday afternoon just to loosen up. And then we started training again on Tuesday. So that's just the way it is.
Coach, do you get back in the water at all with them? I mean, do you show them? Like, I mean, do they know that, you know, you hold a record of the 200 butterfly? Has anybody beaten that yet or what?
Yeah, I have 7 ladies on my team that could beat that now. And so the best thing is, here's how you answer those things. You just say, I was a school record holder, and then you stop.
Yeah. They don't need to know how long ago. They don't need to know for how long. You were just a record holder.
Yeah, I think those records are so hard to find, which is great. And when I came to school, I had Coach Dooley, I spent some time with him just last Thursday for a couple hours over at his house. And, you know, we get a chance to check in all the time. But he hired me. I came to school in 70, but he hired me in the spring of 79. So I just finished the 42nd year.
Nice.
Wow. Yeah, when you talk about, you know, Dooley as the athletic director, I don't think a ton of people have really immersed themselves into the work he did there. I mean, what was that like to watch him develop that part of his career, develop relationships with the people that he hired? You know, we had Coach Landers on here earlier in the running of the podcast, but what was that like to see those days of Dooley as a coach and an AD?
Well, it was actually amazing because, you know, I look at back at Coach and also Coach McGill, Dr. Boyd McWhorter, all Coach Lee Haley. They all taught us without telling us. And it was really amazing. Just being around them, you sort of saw how things were done. And, you know, my mom loved Coach Dooley. You know, she was sitting with him when we won our first national championship in 99, right along with Coach McGill, too, who my second son is named for. But just watching him, and how he treated people. And I was a little bit of a letter writer, you know, in college, but and also in high school. But I was an English major here at Georgia. But Coach made sure, and Coach McGill, anytime we did anything that was of any significance, and believe me, not much was it in the beginning, you know, always got a letter. So because of those two gentlemen in particular, I write a letter a day during the week, and just to someone, might be just a short one page or two page letter, but. It's they taught me the written word was pretty special, and I probably think in this day and age it's even more special to get something handwritten. But they were just good role models. Coach basically hired you and trusted you. I guess that's the best way to tell you how he did it.
Do you think, Jack, that somebody could be an AD and a head coach this day and age?
No, I don't think so. And it's amazing too, because he was just so good at it. I think his last year was 88, you know, when we beat Michigan State in the Gator Bowl. That's when they had, as Berman would say, Bad Moon Rising was playing. And that was a terrific game. That was an unusual game for Coach because he aired it out. What was our quarterback? Was that Johnson, our quarterback at that time, I think? And we threw the ball all over the place. You know, Coach was, you know, I know guys, Mark Hodge, you know, Charlie Whittemore, they were always afraid to drop a ball here because they were afraid that they wouldn't see another one.
Hey, Coach, you talked about a particular event in the 80s. I want to bring up another event. I was doing a little research on you, and I went back and I saw in 83, it said that you and three partners played 125 hours worth of tennis. And you guys raised like over $50,000 for American Cancer Society. My question is, how did you feel the day after that?
Like you've been dragged down a road. And, so we happened. It was actually in 91, Chuck. And I was a young kid at that time, 39.
And crushing me.
But we played 36 hours before we took a break. And. And then we got a three-hour break. You couldn't take all that if you're going to set the record. It was just – here, I'll put it this way. And then we played a day after that, after a two-hour-plus break. And then they woke us up. I felt like I had just woke up from the dead.
And, oh, man.
You know, as bad as you've ever felt on one of your nights, it was twice as bad as that because the whole body – But anyhow, and then we played 24 hours, and we still weren't halfway through. But
insane,
it was pretty amazing.
Man.
This will put it in perspective. Three out of four of the players had major surgery within that next year.
And they look back to that match.
Shoulders.
Yeah, it was a good cause. It was for American Cancer, and all that money went right to the people right here in Athens, Georgia. So it was a good thing to do, but it was it was a hard thing to do. Yeah.
You have some experience coaching Olympians from a team perspective, individual perspective. Can you give us a glimpse into, you know, whether it's just for swimming and diving or in general, how Olympians have handled this adjustment through COVID and rescheduling everything? I mean, this is so insane to me because of the premium on time, obviously, that happens between each Summer Olympics. How's everyone handling this?
It's been tough, Wes, to be honest with you. Just to let you know, I know this is one of my coach's rooms. So we don't have much stuff around. I had to go to make sure I did this right. So I went to his house. He's many years younger than I. I wasn't taking a chance. So I just brought the helmets along with me. I brought the helmets. Got two helmets here along. I brought them in the car. But it's really been hard. But it's got to reward the dedicated ones, because last summer some people took probably a little bit longer breath than they should have. And you know, and it's hard because, you know, you have kids that are 29 years old, and you know, they put everything in their life off for another year. I have two young guys that are not too young. They're 27, 28 years old, getting ready to go to get their master's, and one of them a doctorate in engineering, one of whom is going to Oxford. He got into MIT at Oxford. Yeah, two tough choices there. And then and one of my favorite guys that I've ever coached in my entire career, Nick Fink, who swam here for us, whose dad was one of the executive directors of the NBA. He's going to go to over to North Avenue for his engineering graduate school too. So, all these guys put their lives on hold, but they're so dedicated. They are an extremely good example for our college kids to see how they treat themselves. And Chuck, you know how it is in the professional ranks. So it's a different level how people are committed, completely different. That's the way the Olympians or Olympic hopefuls are. And, you know, we just want to put some more people on the team. But it was hard, particularly when it got yanked out, because, you know, we knew we were in limbo anyhow. And at one point we just said, okay, gang, everybody go home, go somewhere for 10 days and let's regroup again. And that young guy, we had an international swim league this year. He set two American records over there in Budapest. And then we had Olivia Smaliga, who was the captain of our 16 team that won a national championship. She's right out of world record also, and a couple American records. So we had a successful fall. We just need a successful June. Yeah.
I love it. Coach, I want to ask. Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, but in a situation like that where you've got this goalpost and you're pointing at this goalpost, and then somebody moves the goalpost, I would think there's two, and these are a lot of really high-functioning type A individuals. Yeah. There's two things. They're either going to go south on you, or they're going to work twice as hard. And so for the ones that are working twice as hard, how do you keep them from burning out when you now have moved that goalpost another year down the road?
Well, I think the biggest thing was, Mike, that, you know, when they did move it, finally, when we definitively knew they weren't going to have it, I changed the regimen a little bit. We trained once a day for a while. We came in at 8 o'clock, which is, as you know, late for us. And we just did, you know, for about a month and a half straight, we just did a single. I just figured there was no way at that time I could get out of them what they needed. I had to do a total adjustment. And so I took 10 days down in Folly. It was good. It was a good surfing trip. They have put nice waves down there too. So, at any rate, they needed a break. I needed a break. They needed a break from me. I needed a break from them because, you know, I was sort of trying to entertain them and coach them at the same time. You know, we have, it's because it's as you well know, it's a tough sport. It's not easy or your head's in the water. So we try to entertain as much as we can. But once we're in, it's all business. And that's the way it is. We have this day in history every day before we start I put her on the workout. By the way, this was the day that Babe Ruth retired.
Wow.
And
really?
Yeah.
Nice.
And, so they get a little history lesson because, you know, Babe, to me, it was not even arguable that he was the best player ever because he was not. Yeah, I mean, he actually had 1 year where he hit more home runs than the rest of the American League did, which is pretty amazing. And then he was 94-46 as a pitcher, which is top 6 or 7 winning percentage. So, you know, we have to just mix things up. It's a tough sport, so we try to do a little old knowledge for the kids too every day.
Doing that on a diet, consistent diet of everything that we ate Memorial Day weekend.
It's sort of like what we eat at the park. So
Jack, who's the best Philly of all time?
Good question. I know my favorite one of all time, but that's Robin Roberts.
I thought you were going to say Bryce Harper. Sorry.
I got to tell you something. Bryce is one of those guys. If he's on your team, you like him.
Yeah.
He's a baseball player, and he hustles, and he knows how to work stuff. We're missing him. He's been out for 2 weeks now, and it's killing us.
Getting hit in the face will do that.
That'll set you back.
That was a little tougher than what LeBron got, and Harper just walked through the clubhouse, right? But I think to answer your question, the greatest Philly probably is Schmitty, because he's the best third baseman ever to play the game. And it was it was interesting when he played. You guys love this. I had a mom that was not too unlike other mothers in Philadelphia. She would call me. She'd go, Jackson, Schmitty's a bum. And I go, he's so lazy. I said, Mom, he's just a great athlete. He makes it look easy, you know. So, anyhow, I think
my grandmother, who was probably your mom's age, used to always refer to him as Schmitty, would never refer to him as Mike Schmidt. He was always Michael Jack Schmidt.
Michael Jack Schmidt, yep. Went to Ohio University, Athens, Ohio. But he was something. He was a 30-30 guy. But Robin Roberts was my favorite. He threw 32 complete games in one year. I was his guest for the Yankees World Series.
Forget about it.
He was a neat man. He just those guys threw a lot of pitches back days. Yeah, they're babies now.
Coach, I want to ask you a question. It may be stupid. It may be weird. It may be a dumb question. But in this day and age, with the athletes you have now, and I kind of think about in football now, the players are so much bigger, they're faster, they're stronger. Can you put a comparison on athletes from the 80s, the 90s to where they are now? Is it these guys are more skilled? I mean, the women, the men, are they more skilled? I know technology is different, but I know it's at the end of the day, it's swimming, it's water, all that kind of stuff. But is there a difference in the style of athletes now as opposed to maybe 10, 20 years ago?
Yeah, Shaq, the strokes have changed the way we teach them too. And that's we've had a big change in that. And the technology has been a big boom to the change for what we see underwater and on top of the water. And the kids, they know there's everything that has to do with their success is diet and rest and being good mentally too. It's the whole package now if you're going to succeed. It's sort of like watching, when you watch pro football, and I love it tonight. I'm going to watch as much basketball as I can. Growing up in Philly, the 1600 SAT kid in my high school could shoot a rock. everybody could play. And
I'm sure you're a little bum. You got no Embiid tonight.
It's killing me because I think it was sort of neat. We were flying under the radar a little bit, and I think people forget Simmons. Even though we lost that one with, remember when Kawhi hit the lucky shot from the corner?
Simmons, I remember.
He shut him down that day. Simmons had him 10-for-30 for that day. Simmons can play some defense. I love the guy. And then we had
– he just can't shoot no free throws. Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah. I just want Simmons to shoot a three once in a while. That's all. Just shoot a three once in a while.
Like, I think he did one this year. But
I know.
That's a talented guy. And I just love watching. I love pro basketball. I love pro football. I love anything at that highest level. It's just remarkable to watch. But to answer your question, I think athletically we've changed. I think we've gotten some better athletes in swimming, and I also think all the technology has changed, and another thing has changed. We know how to coach them much differently. I have kids that I coached in the 80s are probably not rested still, and but we did a lot more yardage, and now we do a lot more what I would call quality and race-based work, and they are a lot faster. And, just through nutrition and also the weightlifting and the dry land. I mean, we have kids that are, we have a couple kids in our sport that can play any sport really right now.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very athletic.
I, I think it's remarkable. You said just finished up your 42nd year. You're still learning stuff about this particular sport.
Wow. You don't learn much by going to any coaching clinic. You learn everything by calling your buddies. And my my two closest friends, one of whom is now retired. Well, a couple of them. One at Texas just retired. He won 12 or 13 NCAA titles. He and I were, we got along so well as Eddie Reese from Texas. And we just talk, you know, every week. We say, hey, what are you doing today? Bob Bowman, Phelps Hall coach. We just went, it's interesting. We were doing, he said, hey, what are you doing today? I took a picture of the workout. I sent it to him on the phone. He sent a picture back. We were doing virtually, with 6,000 yards of work, we made up virtually the same workout. He's in Phoenix, and I'm here. And it was, so you sort of, you find the guys that you think know the most. And
6,000 yards. Oh, my God. Yeah. You blew my brain right there.
Not even a lot at this time, but it's a lot now because we're coming down. We're in a taper phase. But the bottom line
is. That's tapered? Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, you know, got to rest your legs. Like any other.
That's the cool down.
We got to rest your legs, too. But you just learn a lot from your compatriots, I think. And then, but it's never. And you know, I tell you what, you learn a lot from really good athletes too. If you have an open mind, some of the best kids will show you what they need, and you got to be. And then guess what? And that's hard too because they're all different, especially the last 2 weeks of the season. So can't treat them the
Coach,
same.
Speaking of just the evolution of swimming and history. You know, I was reading recently about the origins of swimming in the Olympics, and it's some stuff that it'll blow people's minds. Just that it used to be like outside in rivers. You know, they used to have like a distance swimming contest, but you couldn't really tell how long anybody had actually been under the water for because they were in rivers. Like, what's the craziest thing about to you about where this sport has evolved from to where it is today?
I'll tell you, I can make this a Georgia question and answer. One of the neatest things that I think ever happened in our sport happened in the 50s. We had a gentleman here who's passed away about in 2015, or 14, Reed Patterson. And Reed was our first NCAA champion. He never saw a pool until he came here from Kentucky. And he learned to swim in a creek. And this is worldwide. He was a neat gentleman. His wife, Anna, I hope she's listening. She'll hear this, I hope. She's a beautiful lady. And Reed was almost like a prototype athlete. Like if he was now, he would be an Olympian now. He was about 6'4", 6'4 and a half, slender, wide shoulders, big hands, big feet. And the kids went in and told Gabrielson, Bump, and said, hey, coach, you need to come out. He said, I'm not coming out. He said, so they took his watch and they timed him for a 50, and he tied the SEC record without a flip turn. And then they went back and showed the coach and said, I think you need to come out and talk to this kid. And so he went on and made the 50s. He won the NCAA title up at Ohio State and went up in a station wagon with Coach McGill. And then in 1956, he went to the Olympic Games. He got fourth. And here's another evolution of swimming. No electronic timing, right? It was done. It was in Melbourne, Australia, that one. And what happened was, guess what? Australia had three guys in there, and they did it off of judges who touched first. Australia got first, second, and third.
Literally looking at it.
Reed got fourth. Wow. Anybody there, I know people that were, they thought either first or second at worst. So he got so mad about it. A month later, he went and set the world record in another meet and broke the world record that those guys set.
That's legendary stuff.
He's a cool guy.
Man, swimming in a – that's right. Coach, when I was there, Coach Rick used to have – we used to come in there and we used to have that time, and Coach Rick would come off the highway. Did you ever give him any advice coming in there with us saying, hey – need to be a little bit careful or make sure you land this way? I mean, do you ever have to give Coach Rick any advice about jumping off the highway?
Well, I got to tell you, the first time I saw it was probably when you guys, Well, the first time I saw it, none of the kids knew. I think it was right around, might have been right around your time was the first time, because they know if they went off the 10-meter, they got out of mat drills, right?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, at that time, we had to put about 8 lifeguards around the diving well. And all I remember was, you know, he went up there and he stood backward, right? I guess, yeah. You know the story. When he was at Miami, they hung out at the pool, and they all messed around down there, and those kids had no idea. And he just went at and did a backflip, and they went nuts.
Yeah.
And I remember, my biggest memory is Rennie Curran. And he went up there, and I don't think he's ever been on a board in his life. And he went up to the 10-meter.
Oh, I remember that. I was there that day. I remember that.
He went in and tried a backflip and landed on his back. And I'm sitting there, I go, okay, this is why I play football. They don't have no fear whatsoever. And, but anyhow, he had fun with that.
He had fun with that, all right, yeah.
Were you there the year, Jack, that they goaded me into going off?
I'm sorry?
Were you there the year that all the players started, Rich called me up and made me go off?
Oh, no way.
So we were there, this would have been like 2011.
I missed a couple of them because of the meets.
But this would have been 2011. That. So Rick calls me. So 2 years ago, two years before, he calls me up. I was for some reason wearing a suit that day. I was like, I am not going off this thing in a suit. And then the next year, I had just a dress shirt and slacks on, and I was like, hell with it. I went.
I didn't know that much.
I never realized how deep. Well, the height didn't bother me.
Yeah.
It was how deep you go.
Yeah, that's you go down. It's
17 feet. And you know, you're nervous, so you're breathing fast. You're burning through oxygen, so you hold your breath, and you go down, and then you start swimming up, and you're like, when am I going to get to the surface? And you start to get a little worried. And I hit the pool so hard, it tore all the buttons off the front of my dress shirt.
better your shirt than your pants. But, that same pool that you jumped in, when we jumped in after our first national championship in 99, I got caught underneath our women's team.
Oh, no.
I
had clothes on. I thought, this is great. I'm gonna die on the first championship, in the night of the first championship. I had a scramble.
Oh, man.
Swimming with clothes on is real different. But anyway,
had to scramble.
Thankfully, you won a few more after that. I can't go that deep. My ears, like, I had really bad ear infections. Yeah, I had tubes in my ears when I was a small kid, and I just can't go that deep anymore. Before the pressure, like, I can't clear it. I can't do it at all. My dad, he does like free diving, so it's not so somewhere.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't get those genes in my ears, so.
Well, Shock, to answer one of your questions, I swim every day, but very little. I have a matter of fact, I live in Mark's old house, Mark Rick's old place.
That's right. You do. I forgot about that.
And he's got a pool back there, and it's just short enough to make it feel like I'm not doing laps.
You were just talking about how guys look these days. When you recruit a kid, do you go in, if he doesn't have broad shoulders, you look at his hands, they look short, his feet a little bit short, you say, okay, let's turn around and get out of here?
Well, yeah, I try to keep it a little longer than that, especially if you're having dinner. But I will say that it's interesting. I mean, we do look at everything, and there are some kids, but there are also kids that – they might have a little bit of a shortcoming physically, but they don't have a shortcoming mentally. And I've been at tables in homes where I've changed a darn scholarship at the table, you know, because you're sitting there and you look at a kid and you look at, and you know, they don't get anything from anyone strange. You know, the influence is right from mother or father or both. And when you see them, and for me, if I see them interacting in a positive way, you know, if I see them look at, you know, the mom and dad say something, I see the kid roll their eyes, I'm out.
Yeah.
All right. If they don't respect mom and dad, they're not going to respect me as a coach either. So we just sort of go our merry way. But this is sort of funny. I had a boy that Nick Fink, he came down on a recruiting trip in the fall. We were playing basketball at one of the coaches' houses. He was in bare feet, and I had a 40% scholarship already for him. He's and all of a sudden he went up and dunked it in bare feet with two hands. And I said, well, it's 75%. I told Nick, he didn't know this until this year. He's 28 years old. I said, Nick, I don't know if you knew, but you got a lot of money off of one shot.
That's incredible.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
Coach, before we let you get out of here, you talked about surfing. I hear you love to surf. Tell us about this love of surfing, and you talk about the waves and all that.
Well, it's pretty neat. I go with a great friend of mine, Chris Davis, another guy, Keith Broom, Jim Fraser, and we've been gone, and Mike Getty sometimes, but we've been gone for about 20-plus years, and we go everywhere. The best trip was about 100 miles off the coast of Sumatra. I mean, we were on a boat,
wow,
about 110-foot boat. We rented it,
wow,
and we were in 10 to 14-foot waves for about 10 days. But it was a little scary because everything was over a reef.
Man.
But we'll be going to Costa Rica. We got shut out of Costa Rica last year, so we went the other way. We went to Maine. But we make a trip together every year. And I grew up as a 10-year-old, 9-year-old, actually surfing up off a small island on New Jersey. And I know what you're thinking, New Jersey, but this island, that our town only had one blinking light in a 2-mile town. It was a beautiful airport. And so I just fell in love with it when I was a kid, and it's just a fun thing to do. That's one reason I get back in the water all the time too, because I want to survive.
10 to 14 foot, I am terrified.
I tell you what, it was easy surfing. All you had to do was get up. It was easy. That we had to get over looking at the wave coming at you. You had to get the fear part done.
Do you look? Do you look at the front of the board? Do you look down the tube or what?
Depending on what you're doing. When you're taking off, you know, you're just looking forward, basically. And then you look left and right and sort of see what's the best way to go, because a wave will break. But over there, it was predominantly left, which was very hard for me because I go predominantly right. But at any rate, you just take a look around, find the best place to go. And then and I like to tell you, we surf like we used to, but we're a little pinkier than we used to be, but we have fun.
Surfing going to be an Olympic sport.
That is cool.
For the first time ever. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. The guys, there's one reason I wish I was born later. I don't wish it because of the music and the time when I was brought up. but I do wish it. When I watch these guys do the things they do on a board, I wish I was brought up now. That would have been so much fun. It's, they just have it. Their imagination runs wild, and anything they think up, they can pretty much do.
Did you say you were at Fallen Beach recently? I was.
Yeah.
We were in Charleston, not this past weekend, but the weekend before that, and I saw a shark fin in the water right off the coast, and I said, "No, sir, I'm getting out." But
Wes, they don't even bother you.
I know they don't.
Wes, they don't mess with you, man. Going out there.
That day, so.
The scary one was when I didn't realize when I paddled over a crocodile that was about 15 feet.
And, what?
And thank God, ignorance is bliss. I never saw it. They were all yelling at me. They were going like this, and I thought a big wave was coming, so I kept going. And evidently, they first thought it was a log, and it was a crocodile. But anyhow.
You know what? Not the first time you've ever beaten a gator. That's what I'm saying.
That's why you are who you are, because you didn't flinch when they did the gator. You didn't flinch.
Well, I think it's safer being in the ocean than it is anytime than it is driving around our campus. So that's the way I look at it.
I'd rather be in the ocean than Lake Lanier on Memorial Day weekend, for sure.
Oh, man, you're going near that. You're right.
Coach Bowerly, full of great stories, great career at Georgia. Thank you so much.
Love it.
For your time. Best of luck this summer. And,
thanks. We start, and, get some prayers our way. Our goal is to put somebody on another Olympic team. We have 31 Olympic medals to our credit, and we want to add some more. Yeah,
no doubt.
Love it.
Thanks.
Go Dawgs.
Guys, I appreciate the time.
Coach Jack.
Appreciate you, Coach.
I'm going to go home now.
thanks for listening to Shock and Ship. Leave us a review, rate us, all that good stuff. We'll catch you next time.